Welcome to the Talking Tall Rounds series, brought to you by the Seidel and Arnold Miller Family Heart, Vascular, and Thoracic Institute at Cleveland Clinic.
We're going to be presenting another interesting disease scenario from our annals of chest medicine and chest surgery here at Cleveland Clinic main campus. We're going to start today's presentation with Dr. Mike Jaworski, one of our residents, who will introduce the case to the audience. Mike?
So I will start with the case. This is a 28-year-old male who presented with worsening shortness of breath, wheezing, and hemoptysis over several weeks. He had no significant medical history, and he was a non-smoker. On exam, he had bilateral expiratory wheezing, and he was sating 98% on room air. In the emergency room, the CT scan showed a 1.5 by 1.5 centimeter mass in the distal trachea. The differential diagnosis was clot versus neoplasm. The patient was intubated with a rigid bronchoscope, and an exophytic mass emanating from the right distal trachea was seen, obstructing 80% of the lumen. The lesion was cored out, and bleeding was controlled with pressure, ice-cold saline, and then cautery. After this, his respiratory symptoms were palliated, and he was discharged home with follow-up for surgical planning. The final pathology was mucoepidermoid carcinoma. A repeat bronchoscopy before surgery was done, and it showed that the lesion was isolated in the distal trachea with a focal stalk. So the patient was taken to the operating room, and a mediastinoscopy was first performed, and this was done by anterior dissection of the trachea and left main stem. After this was done, the patient was put on veno-venous ECMO with percutaneous access in the right IJ and right common femoral vein. The patient was repositioned into the left lateral decubitus, and ventilation was discontinued. Four ports were then placed into the patient, and the Da Vinci robot was docked onto the patient. After this, after gaining access to the thoracic cavity, the distal trachea and the main stem bronchi were mobilized, and then a right hilar release was performed as well. Once the trachea was fully mobilized, the distal trachea was resected, and after margins were negative, an end-to-end anastomosis was performed with a vascularized pedicle flap buttressed the anastomosis. Once this was done and the air leak was confirmed to be negative, the ECMO was decannulated and he was extubated in the OR. The patient was transferred to the step-down unit post-op day one, and he was discharged on post-op day three. 6 months post-op, the patient's doing well, he's exercising again, and bronchoscopy showed a well-healed anastomosis with no lesions. Thank you.
So the problem was, of course, that we had this tumor in the distal trachea, and we have to resect and reconstruct that, and it's a fairly uncommon operation even here. It's done for benign and malignant conditions. You've heard about some of the cancers that impact the distal airway. We see benign tracheostenosis, and Mike and I have managed those as well with this type of approach using a combined interventional bronchoscopy and surgical approach. And the airway control during the operation, as you can imagine, when you're cutting on the airway, can be quite complex. So this is the airway, and just to highlight everyone, we're down here, close to the carina. Veno-veno ECMO seems to be a nice adjunct to these types of operations to really free up the airway of the ventricular appliance. The advantages is we're oxygenating on the venous side of the heart. You got to understand that. So the blood that is being oxygenated is going into the right side of the heart and is going back through the lungs themselves and actually loses a fair bit of his oxygenation during that travel. It then returns to the arterial side and is somewhat desaturated, but more than sufficiently saturated to provide reasonable oxygenation for the systemic circulation. More importantly, the carbon dioxide is scrubbed by the machine, and so you're really sending peripheral arterial blood that is has relatively normal carbon dioxide profiles. The advantage of the ECMO circuit in our case, and we're trying to do things with less collateral damage here, there's percutaneous access, and you saw Pat show some of the catheters that we use. So, but there are disadvantages to this technology, as there are with most things. You need a perfusion team like Pat has behind him and that I have behind me. These kinds of technologies and techniques are not necessarily universally translatable to other institutes across the country. And you can imagine having these big catheters in some of these central veins for periods, extended periods of time, does leave the patient open for deep venous thrombosis, which is not particularly uncommon in some of these cases. So why would you use veno-veno-ectomy in a case like this? Well, it should dramatically simplify intraoperative airway control. And I think it allows for an unobstructed reconstruction. And when you're trying to pull two pieces of tissue together, the last thing you really need is a foreign body, an endotracheal tube that is in the way. So I'm going to show you two different ways how we do this kind of operation, both of them using ECMO. So we'll start with the old way. So this is a different patient and a different tumor. This is actually a squamous cell tumor. And I think Mike actually saw this one too, because it's got his fingerprints over it. That's the PET scan. So this one, as Jason was telling you about using PET scan for airway tumors. So this one, this lesion was fairly PET positive, actually. There's the snare, I think, that Mike had through a rigid bronchoscope. So he's snaring down on the lesion and getting it out of the way. And that's what was left. So it's almost identical presentation, very close to where the case that we're talking about right now was, but it's slightly different, slightly more central in the airway, on the membranous part of the airway. When we were looking at this case, we had a plan of an autofluorescence bronchoscopy to really look for a field cancerization phenomenon, because this one actually was a squamous cell cancer. We started the case with a mediastinoscopy, which was used to both stage the cancer as well as to free up the airway. You know, we have to remember that we're going to be removing a segment of airway, and so the two cut ends have to be able to be reapproximated in as free a manner as possible, so tension has to be relaxed. And the mediastinoscopy does, in fact, do that. The veno-veno-ECMO setup was as Pat just went over in this case, which was the drainage catheter to the ECMO machine was a 24 French put in through the right femoral vein, and the return or the inflow to the patient was through the right IJ, and it was an 18 French catheter. We used a thoracotomy here. I guess we were a little nervous about doing things really minimally invasively, and this is a few years ago. So this is the standard schema for the ECMO, and the ECMO was put in first, and then the mediastinoscopy was done second, and then the patient was positioned for a right side approach. So here's the autofluorescence bronchoscopy, and you can see that blush. That's what we're kind of looking. That's kind of the vasculature of the mucosa, and there was nothing else. So here's the mediastinoscopy. Down below is the airway. So this is the trachea down here. These are the investing tissues, and that scope is used to dissect that area. So here's the thoracotomy. That's the azygous vein that's being divided. It's an important landmark that overlies the airway very close to the carina, perhaps a centimeter away. So it's just divided. We've gotten around the airway there. That's the airway where you see that tape around it. And we're pulling out lymph nodes, and you heard from Christine Booth about some of the staging. And again, these are cancer operations, so we do take out lymph nodes. So we're cutting the airway now, and that catheter you see in there is just an oxygen exchange. It's a tube exchange catheter. It's not an endotracheal tube. So that's just to blow by oxygen to the contralateral lung to additionally oxygenate the patient. But you see that we're totally free. So we're starting to cut the airway now. And we often use bronchoscopy to help us define where we incise the airway. The last thing you need to do is take out too much airway that you suddenly then cannot reconstruct. So we're cutting on both sides of where we think the lesion is. And we're just doing this sharply here. And we take additional margins and cut further back, but we just, that's kind of where the lesion was. And then we're going to just sew everything together. So there's really no appliance. We have that little jet catheter there that just to apply oxygen. That's the membranous part that we're closing. And here's the final close here. So we're kind of cut the sutures. Most of the time, we like to separate the airway reconstruction from tissues around it, which would include, say, the aorta and esophagus below, and the pulmonary artery above. So we get a vascularized flap of the thymus that we mobilize. And then we bring up the lung. Hopefully there's no significant air leak. You can't leave a case like this with an air leak. This has to be completely pneumostatic. So that was a 5-day hospital stay. And it was, that person had negative margins. and I don't want to get Christine too excited here, but this was the pathology that we had. We'll move on. So what's the new way? And I'm not sure this is the new way everywhere. This is still what I would consider an experimental procedure to do this kind of procedure with robotics, where the biggest incision is maybe about a half inch, and we have probably four of those poke holes to do the exact same operation we just did with an 8-inch incision. So, but robotics, there's no doubt that it's a technology that's here to stay. And the optics are just terrific. And I think we leverage the optics and the magnification, which are generally between 5 and 10 times the human eye, to really do the operations and to understand anatomy. And we actually in our group have demonstrated oncologic legitimacy of using the robot for lung cancer resection. So we're pretty comfortable that it provides at least the same oncologic impact. And we think it is, when done hopefully in experienced hands, far more user-friendly from a patient side. So we thought, why not try it here? So this is the lesion that you've all now will see in your dreams tonight. This is actually Mike's initial bronchoscopy image. And this is when he finished, and you saw that as well. There's his rigid bronchoscope, and there's that char that he left behind. So just to review, you heard from Christine about the pathology and Jason about some of the other studies and Mike about what he did. And so we had a mucoepidermoid, which was considered low grade. And this was a completely fit, never smoking man who is only 28 years old. So our operative plan were to perform a flexible bronchoscopy, and we used some autofluorescence. I'm not going to show you that in this video. We did the mediastinoscopy to fully free up the central mediastinum and to biopsy additional lymph nodes there. We also stuff a gauze pack in that central mediastinum that we retrieve when we go in through the right chest. We instituted vino-vino ECMO, and the inflow was the 18 French, and the outflow to the machine was the 24. I generally use fluoro in these kinds of cases. We don't really need a TE ECHO. This is VV ECMO, not AV ECMO. And then our plan was a right-sided approach and a distal trachea resection and reconstruction using the da Vinci XI platform. So this was the schema of the vino-vino ECMO circuit as you've seen before. So this is a little different optics. That's the azygous vein, the one you saw shrouded in blood when we did the thoracotomy. These are some lymph nodes that come out often whole. Here's some lymph nodes in the subcarina where the whole packet is coming out. And these were some of the lymph nodes that were passed back to Christine and her team for that. So this is, believe it or not, the left side of the airway. The esophagus is to the left of the picture. That's the cut end of the azygos. And we're getting around the airway. This is the front of the airway. There's the other cut end of the esophagus. That's the SVC pulsing away because the ECMO cannula is in there. So we're going to dissect on top of the airway, and there's that gauze right in there that we placed from the mediastinoscopy. So that freed up, so that gauze gets pulled out. And we're going to get around the airway here using our techniques. Just if we go a little lateral, we're going to get the recurrent nerve on the left side. So just like in the open procedure, we get around the airway. So now we do, I didn't show on the last film, but we talked about, this is going to be a Hyla release where we're just releasing the pericardium from the left side, the right side of the left atrium. So this is underneath the atrium. That's the left atrium there. We're going to hook that around. These are some of the veins, the inferior pulmonary vein right there. That's the phrenic nerve just to the right of the dissector. So again, here's our airway. And you can see the carina. This is right airway, this is left. And we're going to cut this segment of airway out. Now we have ECMO, so we don't have to worry about breathing the patient right now. And we're going to take a sleeve of airway. We always generally, again, take out a few margins, and this is a few other rings just to make sure. And we've checked margins, and then we put it together. And here is my diagram telling the resident what to do. And as you can imagine, that was just the diagram. There's a fair bit of language that comes with that when you're trying to tell them what to do. And we sew this back up together. And then again, the all-important leak test. And we're going to take the thymus, and we can use the robot to do the thymus and put that right over the top. So the critical element of this intervention is that it has to be really identical and really recapitulate. There's the immediate post-op, and there's the one 3 months later that actually I think Mike saw this patient in follow-up. The one thing about these procedures is they really have to recapitulate the open operation or be better. Otherwise, there's very limited value just to do them from a patient perspective. So the post-operative course was unremarkable. The guy got out very quick, as actually Mike Jaworski had said. It was just a short stay. And as Christine reviewed the final pathology with negative margins, and the patient returned to work in 4 weeks. So I just wanted to highlight overall that this is not a one-man or woman show. This is a team sport. And you've seen some of the team members, some of whom were involved in this case and were critical elements of the case. You know, you got to be rowing together. This is my daughter's it's a regatta, and you can see where the coxswain is at the very front of the boat. It turns out that they were actually rowing in the wrong direction. The start of the race is over here to the right, and you can see the boys' boat was actually going. So not only are you in the same boat together in rowing, but you better be going in the right direction. So those are the two important lessons. And with that, I think we'll stop and field any questions from outside, but maybe I have a few things for some of the people up here as well. And thank you for your attention. Let's see, I think I wanted to ask, Jason about any novel agents for PET scans. You know, we've heard about oxygen, O15. Is there anything on the horizon for imaging that would replace our standard FDG PET for cancer imaging? Are you aware of anything?
That's a great question. I'm not aware of anything that's in the works right now.
Okay.
I mean, there are certain cancers that have certain agents that are preferential for those cancers, but I'm not aware of anything that would be pretty standard across the spectrum.
Yeah, it seems like we've been stuck on FDG PET, the FDG, for the better part of 15 years, right? Or even longer than that.
Correct. Yeah, and it's not terribly specific, as I mentioned, because infections light up at least as bright as cancers. So it doesn't necessarily help narrow down the differential too much, but as we all know, it helps to stage, do a survey over the entire body since it is full body imaging, and it could help narrow down the differential a bit. But I'm not aware of anything else that's in the works.
So I got one for Christine, and this is the bane of the surgeon's existence, and that is crush artifact. You know, we get you guys a biopsy, and then we hear we can't tell because it's crush artifact. So what is that, and when should we worry about that?
So I think it's when the tissue is actually pinched in or cauterized. Those are two times. So when the tissue becomes pinched or cauterized, the cells become crushed. And certain tumors, like small cell, will look very crushed anyway because of their high nuclear to cytoplasmic ratio. So, but when you see a sea of what looks like crushing, you can still immunostain those tumors sometimes and get results with crush, but it can be difficult when you can't actually see the cells when they're crushed.
Yeah, I hate hearing that from the pathology team. Specimen is crushed artifact. And for Mitch, I wanted to ask you, Mike, what other ablative, endobronchial ablative strategies do we have, maybe for not a tumor this big, but other energy sources or cryo or PDT? What's the latest on other laser, on other strategies to treat central airway cancers?
Sure. As Sid mentioned, there's a lot of modalities out there. Laser, cautery have been the mainstays. Argon has also been very popular. And cryotherapy is probably the newest and what most people are considering the best right now. There's a cryo probe, but the cryo spray is really what's been becoming more popular as of late. PDT, which was an old therapy, has also had a little bit of a resurgence in the world as well. Each of them have their own pluses and minuses. With the cryo spray, you got to be very diligent about making sure you vent because it's a high pressure, high flow rate. So we don't want to cause any air embolism. We've seen cases of pneumothoraces in some of these. And PDT, obviously, there's all the light exposure that you got to be wary of, as well as the expense.
Great. And last thing, Pat, I just had a question for you about latest cannula. You know, are we getting to lower profile, higher flows? You know, that the lower the profile and the higher the flows seems like it would be the better the cannula, as long as we're not disrupting red cells, causing lysis, et cetera. And I always prefer really short cannulas, particularly in the IJ, that are even 16 French, that if they're short enough, sometimes we can generate those flows of 4 liters that you guys like to see. Is there some advancement or some continued development of some of these inflow and outflow cannulas that we're trying to trial and now use here?
Yeah, so they're just starting to release some with Elastion, gives them a smaller, thinner profile. So they're starting to do that, and they're starting to get them approved for longer than 6 hours. So recently, or in the past, that we've used the same cannula as we use in open heart surgery. So they're working on these types of cannulas being approved for long term. They're looking at other ones if you do a fem-fem approach for VV ECMO with a long cannula that goes right into the heart and then a shorter cannula for the drainage. So some of those different configurations, and those should be FDA approved within the next month or two.
Yeah, you can imagine that, you know, this guy, I think, was decannulated in an operating room, and I don't think Mike Jaworski was there, but I could have asked him the question, how long did you have to hold pressure in this gentleman's groin, which is not insignificant. He had a 24 French cannula in a you know, adult male's groin. There's a fair bit of pressure, and it's a good thing Mike played football at BC, because we need that kind of training to hold pressure. But when you do that, you do get some DVTs that arise. And we often study these patients with duplex after on day of discharge, just to make sure we're not sending home someone who's going to have a catastrophic pulmonary embolism. And it is not infrequent that we find some element of clot burden in the ipsilateral lower extremity that was cannulated. And we're not sure if it's the cannula or the pressure, because these are put in percutaneously. I think with that, I don't have anything else. And if is there anything from the audience, either here or out in cyberspace, that needs to be addressed?
What's your typical anticoagulation strategy in these kind of cases?
So the question from the vast audience here was, what is the anticoagulation strategy intraoperatively and perhaps even postoperatively? So that's a very good question. So these cannulas are actually designed at some level to be used without full heparinization. And we're doing an operation, and if we're fully heparinized, you can imagine the problems with bleeding. Personally, I just bolus these patients at induction with about 5,000 of heparin and get the cannulas in. By the time we get to the operation, from when the catheters go in, is about an hour or so, just because we got to do you got to reposition and prep and everything else. So by that time, you know, you're already past one half-life of the heparin. But I'll throw that to Pat. Pat, how comfortable are you guys with a heparin bolus running at 4 liters flow without any additional heparin, given that these are all, I assume, Carmina bonded or something? They're all bonded, right, and supposed to be non-thrombogenic, correct? So how what's your comfort level? Because we pretty much go with what you guys, when you guys get nervous.
Yeah, I think we're a little bit more nervous than you are, but we do give the initial bolus of heparin when they're cannulating. But as soon as flow is going through the cannulas, it doesn't seem to be an issue. You know, there's a paper out of here that showed VV ECMO with no heparinization was no different than VV ECMO with heparinization. So I think we feel a lot more comfortable now after looking at our own numbers.
Yeah. So that's the other issue is, what do you do after? So that's a different issue, and I don't know we know that answer. And again, as we know, we have injured two central veins, IJ in this case, and the femoral. And should we have patients on any coagulation? For transplants, I used to do that, run them on some heparin after they more decannulated, but we just use Lovenox and prophylaxis for this. I don't think, and then we study them at time of discharge. All right. Well, with that, we will adjourn this edition of Tall Rounds, and thank you all for your attention, and have a good day.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. Like what you heard? Visit Tall Rounds online at clevelandclinic.org/tallrounds and subscribe for free access to more education on the go.